This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Israel's long-lasting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu looks like he could actually be ousted from power after many, many attempts. It looks like this might actually be the one. To learn about this and what it means for Israel's future, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
This is a story that we have been tracking because Israel has been gone through four different elections in the past couple of years. And each time Netanyahu has emerged as being able to continue to lead the government, although the government would be in question and there'd be a new election. Well, on Wednesday night, or just before on Wednesday night, there was a decision made by Yair Lapid, who received the mandate from President Reuven Rivlin to try and form a coalition. And he decided that he can form a coalition, bringing together eight separate parties in a massive coalition deal that brings together an Arab party for the first time in Israeli politics, joining the government, as well as three right-wing parties further to the right than Netanyahu's Likud, the two left-wing parties of Labor and Meretz as well. And then Blue and White by Benny Gantz. And, of course, Yesh Latid is a centrist party as well. And so you've got eight parties now that are going to come together to try and make 61 seats to get the majority in the Knesset, which would then push Likud, the largest single vote getter in the previous election, but not enough to form a majority with its leader, Prime Minister Netanyahu, into the opposition. For the first time in 12 years, he would no longer be prime minister. Now, there is some question marks still over this because they have about a week, or just under a week, actually, till next Wednesday, it seems, when the Knesset is going to formally vote and ratify what has been signed on the piece of paper. And they're going to decide whether, well, Netanyahu is going to use the next 4 or 5 days to try and reach out to possible defectors amongst the right-wing parties, most likely, to see if they're going to break from party rank. Because if one or two of them do, then they wouldn't have the majority in the Knesset and this government would fall flat. So there is the opportunity for this not to pan out this way. However, everyone so far that has signed onto the agreement is sticking to their guns, and it looks like Mr. Netanyahu will be gone next week.
So you mentioned you have this incredibly diverse coalition, eight different parties from all over the political map. Really, the one thing that is unifying them is getting rid of Benjamin Netanyahu. And there's concern that once that is accomplished, which it very well could be unless something dramatic changes, this won't last another day.
Right. It really can't last that long if the government intends to put forth any type of policy, any type, which governments do, any type of new laws through the Knesset. Because just take, for example, you have people that have voted for the left parties that are very much against any type of Israeli settlement or construction inside the West Bank. They're in this government. And then you have parties such as Yamina, whose the leader is Naftali Bennett. He's further to the right from Netanyahu, and he's going to be the prime minister. And every one of his voters voted for him because he believes in Israel annexing the West Bank, and he's strongly supportive of further settlement construction. That's day one. Day two, you could have further uptick in violence of the Arabs against the government of Israel, against Israelis, Jewish Israelis. And so then you have the Ra'am party, who have eight seats inside this group. That are they going to side with the Arabs, Arab public, or are they going to side with the defense establishment from the government that tries to put down the violence? And so there are a host of ways of that this government won't survive. However, the most important element for all these parties, including the right-wing ones, is to remove the man that has, as far as Western eyes see it, successfully led Israel for the past 12 years. That is their number one goal. And they, it seems, are going to go against some of their party, against their constituents' wishes by even removing him from power, because most of the people that voted for Naftali Bennett believed him never to go into an agreement with an Arab party or with the left even. And yet that's exactly what he has done. He promised twice in the last election cycle that he would not do what he has just done. And so what do those voters do? And so it's hard to see this government lasting for any length of time. However, perhaps it's enough, or it will be enough, it seems, to move Netanyahu from his throne.
Now, you wrote about this in the Trumpet brief that was distributed last night, and I really recommend that our listeners go read that article. It's up at the trumpet.com right now, Will Israel Lose Its Churchill? And you mention the fact that there is a certain consensus among Israelis that the greatest threat facing Israel is Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu has been famously strong in defending his nation against that threat. You make the point that Benjamin Netanyahu actually recognizes an even greater threat that none of these other politicians do. Could you explain that?
Right. So across the board, even the left-wing Meretz party, they believe in stopping Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. They don't want the nuclear, well, they want a strong nuclear deal, let's put it that way. And so there is consensus on this issue. However, what Netanyahu sees is that the United States right now, under President Biden, is firmly supporting Iran in its nuclear ambitions, that the United States is fundamentally now turning into an adversary of the state of Israel. And Netanyahu is not scared to speak up against the United States president administration. He did that back in 2015 in March when he spoke before a joint session of Congress, as Obama was fuming that the prime minister of Israel would come into the People's House in America and declare that the Iran nuclear deal was a disaster, a danger for Israel and for the West as well. And Prime Minister Netanyahu is willing to do that again. He has done. This past week, he spoke at the changeover ceremony of the leader of the Mossad over here. And what he said, a lot of Israelis don't like, a lot of the Israelis on the left don't like. He said, if we have to choose, I hope it doesn't happen, between friction with our great friend, the United States, and eliminating the existential threat wins. Meaning that if the United States is all for Iran, and we are going to discard our friendship with the United States for the time being and take out Iran if we have to. And the response to that, even from Benny Gantz, who's in Washington, D.C. right now meeting with Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, they came out and said, well, if we have disagreements between the United States and Israel, we need to be quiet about them. We need to talk about them behind closed doors. Prime Minister Netanyahu is the only one that understands you cannot do that. You need to shove it back in their faces. You need to let the American people know what the Obama administration, part two, is doing right now through the Biden presidency, because the American public are not for it. The American public is still firmly pro-Israel. And furthermore, looking at what they're doing right now, you've got, through statements like this, you have the Prime Minister of Israel still trying to preserve what the Trump administration did. A statement such as that, where he says that we'll destroy Iran if we have to and risk that friendship with the United States, that wasn't just for Israelis. That wasn't even a warning for the Biden administration. That was for all the other Arab states that are terrified of Iran, that are terrified that Israel is going to go along quietly, meekly with the United States. The Arab states are terrified about what Iran is doing right now. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, who signed a peace deal with Israel, all these others, they're wondering what's going to happen with the Biden administration supporting Iran. And Israel's prime minister came out vocally just this week and said, we're going to stand up to the U.S. if we have to. He was doing that for the Arab states, for them to see that Israel still had their back. Now, who's going to do that? I can't see Naftali Bennett doing that. He's going to be in awe of himself as he's now the prime minister, something he's coveted for such a long time, and he's gotten there through scheming and what all politicians do, I suppose. However, he's not going to do it, and certainly not Yesh Atid, Yair Lapid, who's the leader of the largest party now in this coalition. He supports going back to some type of Iran deal. So a strong Iran deal. So what we have right now is a dangerous lack, if he leaves, of a political force in Israel that is going to be willing to stand up to the United States, who is backing Iran. Donald Trump is out of the scene for the time being. Prime Minister Netanyahu is out of the scene right now. They were the two loudest spokesmen against Iran's rise and what the Obama administration did to make that happen. Who is going to be the watchman now? And in this article, I talk about how Mr. Flurry has highlighted in the past that Netanyahu did act like Winston Churchill, warning the world about what Iran's nuclear program was meant to achieve in the end, the destruction of the Jewish state as its goal. And it's hard to see anybody standing up like he did if he's out of office.
Well, we appreciate you bringing that to us. And again, I really encourage you to read Brent's article, Will Israel Lose Its Churchill? And we will definitely keep our eyes on what happens. The clock is ticking on Netanyahu in a way that it hasn't for a long time. And Brent, I think you do a good job of just helping to show how dangerous a moment this is for Israel. We appreciate that very much. American soldiers committed a serious security breach over the nuclear weapons stationed in Europe. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, looking after nuclear weapons is complicated, and you'd expect it to be. You'd expect there to be all kinds of relatively complicated security procedures, things you had to memorize, passwords you need to memorize, etc. The problem is American soldiers decided that they would turn to free online revision tools to help them memorize all of these details, the kind of thing that you might use to build flashcards and things like this to study for a test. Those things are often pretty good for studying for a test. They're not designed to keep nuclear information secret. And so because they did this, basically top secret information about America's overseas military bases has leaked out into the open. The private investigating network Bellingcat published research into this on May 28th. And they wrote that American soldiers had inadvertently revealed a multitude of sensitive security protocols about U.S. nuclear weapons and the bases at which they are stored. So these leaks reveal exactly where these bases are or these nuclear weapons are, which shelters they're in, which vaults contain actual nuclear weapons, whereas which vaults are just kind of dummies or which are empty. Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, who's the director of the East Asian Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, he said it was a flagrant breach. And he said secrecy about U.S. nuclear weapon deployments. He just talked about this is just one more warning that these weapons are not secure. And this is not the first kind of farcical security breach when it comes to America's nuclear weapons. In Europe, there was, again, an incident that would be comical if it weren't so serious about 10 years ago, where a bunch of peace activists decided they were going to protest and demonstrate at Belgium's Kleinbrogel Air Base. This is an air base in Belgium where American nuclear weapons are stored. And their plan for the protest was to break into the air base and get arrested. And in doing so, draw attention to these nuclear weapons. Well, the first part of their plan went okay. They broke into the airbase. They found it surprisingly hard to get arrested and ended up aimlessly wandering around the airbase, finding doors open, wandering into different areas. And it took quite some time before anyone finally showed up. And I don't think even then they arrested them. They just kind of nodded them off the site. They came back a little bit later, a few months later, and then they even found unlocked nuclear bomb shelters and kind of wandered in and started taking selfies with the equipment and all of this. So it is hard to exaggerate how bad the security around a lot of America's nuclear weapons in these overseas bases is.
Now, Gerald Flurry wrote about that incident that took place some time ago, and he just drew attention to how this really does relate to prophecies regarding America's nuclear capabilities being misused or used against them. Herbert W. Armstrong talked about this. He referred back to that. Maybe you could just set the stage for the why this is significant prophetically.
Yeah, I think the response to lots of people when reading about these stories is, wait, America has nuclear weapons in Europe? It's not something that is really widely known, but America has handed over a lot of nuclear weapons to other countries. So there are, I think, 6 nuclear sharing countries: Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, Turkey even. These countries where they don't have their own nuclear weapons, but America has given them theirs. And in theory, America retains control of these bombs, and America has to approve before they can be used. But then they would go on a German airplane or an Italian or Turkish airplane, and these countries could use them. So the idea being, well, Germany, you don't have to have your own nuclear weapons program. We'll give you some, and if you get nuked by Russia, you can go and nuke them back. But that America would do this, that America would give the most destructive weapon man has ever produced to other countries, just shows how completely America trusts those countries. And in recent years, there's been a bit of attention drawn to the ones in Turkey, as Turkey becomes more and more kind of Islamist, and they're sitting there with American nuclear weapons. But there's pretty much complete trust from America for these countries. And then not only are they giving the sending these nuclear weapons over there, but they're completely relaxed about their security as well. There's no real concern about even keeping these nuclear weapons safe within Germany, within these other countries. It's, like I said, absolute, complete, total trust. And this is exactly the kind of thing the Bible talks about. The Bible has some very specific prophecies about Britain, about America, trusting their foreign lovers, these other countries that they believe really love them, even to the point that they give gifts to these foreign lovers. And is there a more potent gift than a nuclear weapon? You see that level of trust, and the Bible vividly warns that trust is going to be betrayed. And like you said, Mr. Flurry has that article of Europe's nuclear secret that talks about what America has done here. You know, these bombs have been sitting there for decades with almost no security. So the host countries will have been able to do just about anything they wanted if they wanted to get access to them. Mr. Flurry, in that article, he talks about a warning from history. You know, you just look at history and surprise attacks are a thing. They're pretty common. There's just an ignorance of history, and then an ignorance especially of Bible prophecy as well. He talks about how abominable this kind of looking to foreign lovers instead of looking to God for security, how abominable that is to God. He goes through that. And so, you know, it is a pretty disturbing level of trust, and it will have some disturbing outcomes. And then Mr. Flurry also concludes, though, in that article by putting it in context of the hope as well, and God's plan for mankind.
Well, we do have an article on this subject by Josue Michels up at thetrumpet.com right now. How secure are America's nukes in Europe? With quotes from what Gerald Flurry wrote in that article from some time ago, Europe's Nuclear Secret. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. We're going to look now at another example of America's strategic vulnerabilities. The nation has been hit by 2 high-profile cyber attacks that took out a major oil pipeline, the world's largest meat processing company. This alerted many Americans to this cyber threat, specifically from Russia. Well, this week, another such attack by Russia became known. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, some hackers that are associated with Russia's leading intelligence agency seized control of one of the U.S. State Department's main email systems over the last few days. This particular email system is one that the State Department's International Aid Agency uses. And so these Russians were able to use their access to actually burrow into the computer networks of several different human rights groups. And they targeted especially those groups that have been critical of Russian President Vladimir Putin. So it's really about Putin attacking his enemies, attacking the groups that have exposed his corruption. So what the hackers did here, it's being called a particularly bold attack, because by targeting the systems of a supplier used by the U.S. federal government, they were able to implant code with a kind of a phishing scheme that gave them just unlimited access to the computer systems of many of these recipients. And then they were able to use that to go after Putin's enemies, both in the U.S. and elsewhere. Nobelium is the Russian group behind this attack, And as I said, they were directed by the SVR. That's Russia's main intelligence group. And so this is just another very disturbing look at how vulnerable many of the U.S.'s most important systems are and just how determined America's enemies are to exploit those vulnerabilities.
So this is right in the context, as I said earlier, of these other cyber attacks that have been committed. The pipeline attack could be Russia. It hasn't been proven. The meat processing attack definitely was from Russia. Russia is definitely using this as a weapon against the United States right now.
Very much so. Yeah, I'd like to just talk a little bit about that meat processing attack. That was also this week, and that was on JBS, which is the world's largest meat processing company. The company is owned by Brazil, but the operations that the Russian hackers targeted look to be only those used in the U.S., Canada, and Australia. So they're very, very precise with how they use this hacking, this weapon. And it was a major hack. This shut down 22% of America's beef and pork slaughtering capacity. And we're just starting to see what kinds of shortages and price increases will result from this. So that one is believed to have been carried out by Revil, which is one of the most prolific and just profitable cyber criminal groups out there. And they are Russian. But in this case, they don't seem to be operating with the backing of the Russian government, from what we can tell. So that differentiates the JBS attack from the attack on the U.S. State Department, which was almost certainly directed by Vladimir Putin's government. And then, as you mentioned, there was also the attack a few weeks back on the Colonial Pipeline here in the U.S. That was one that many Americans personally felt the effects of, especially in the Southeast, with gas shortages. And it only ended after the hackers were paid a ransom of millions of dollars. And then going back a little further, we can't forget about the very sophisticated SolarWinds hacking operation discovered back in December. That one, as you said, it's not totally conclusive that it was Russia, but all the signs seem to be pointing to the fact that that was Russian hackers. So it's becoming a usual occurrence, and Americans are beginning to see, I think, just how vulnerable they've made themselves by becoming dependent on technology, especially cyber technology, in just so many different fields.
We talked about how prophecy informs us of the dangers of these security breaches in America's nuclear weapons. Talk about the what prophecy says about these cyber attacks.
Sure, yeah. Bible prophecy talks about a time on the horizon when the United States and some of its current allies will be besieged by Russia and its allies. Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 and Deuteronomy as well give some details about that. And then Ezekiel 7 verse 14 provides even more information about this future time of chaos. It says, quote, "They have blown the trumpet, even to make all ready, but none goes to battle, for my wrath is upon all the multitude thereof." So Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has talked about this being a time when everyone expects the people of the U.S. to go to battle, because, you know, they're being attacked. But nobody goes, even though the trumpet is blown. And he's written several times over the years that that failure to go to battle will be largely because America will have been hit by computer terrorists. And Mr. Fleury has said the U.S.'s excessive reliance on various cyber technologies is, in a sense, the country's Achilles heel, because we're just so vulnerable in that area. So I think in light of this prophecy in Ezekiel and that insight there about America's Achilles heel, I think all these stories about Russia hacking various aspects of the U.S. are just very important for us to keep a close eye on.
All right. Well, we will link to that article, America's Achilles Heel, in the show notes for today's program. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. And also, if I didn't say so, thank you, Richard, for your report as well. The Biden administration is seeking to spend billions of dollars on electric vehicles. This policy will have some unsavory, presumably unintended consequences. To learn about these, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the details of the $6 trillion budget proposal I talked about last week are coming out day by day as people go through the 1,700 pages of that document. And as you mentioned, he's earmarked about $174 billion for electric cars. And it looks like if he gets his way, that's going to be about $45 billion of that is going to be towards making electric car charging stations across the nation. $100 billion of it is more like rebates to like those who buy an electric car, get a certain amount of government amount of money from the government to make it more affordable. But the goal is within the next 10 years to have about 35 million electric cars on the road. And so that'd be a big change for America. But as you mentioned, when you start looking into the nitty gritty details of exactly how to accomplish this goal, you start seeing, like I said, some unsavory details that could really hurt the environment and will definitely really strengthen the Chinese Communist Party. Because electric vehicles, I mean, they to be able to recharge it, I mean, you need a pretty high-tech battery to have a vehicle that runs, that you can just plug into the wall, it stores electricity, and then you can drive it with no gasoline whatsoever. And those batteries are expensive and involved to manufacture. And they actually require about six times the amount of rare earth minerals that a conventional vehicle uses. A conventional vehicle only has maybe about 200 pounds of minerals in it, and about half of that is copper. Where when you're looking at these high-tech lithium batteries, I mean, you're looking about 300 pounds of rare earth minerals. And so if you want 35 million of these things on the road, I mean, this is... I think well over 2 million tons of rare earth minerals that America is going to need over the next 10 years to put all these on the road, which is somewhat concerning just because right now we're already importing 80% of the rare earth minerals we use for electronics from China. And now we're going to need a bunch more. And so, like, where are we going to get it? Now, I guess to its credit, the Biden administration does have a plan to ramp up American rare earth mineral production for the first time in decades. But looking at the just the increased amount you're going to need for all these windmills and electric cars and other things you're going to need, it's definitely going to benefit China, especially in the short term. I mean, in the next 3 or 4 years, America is going to be like completely almost at China's mercy for all these rare earth minerals it's going to need for these type of projects. But even after that, even like assuming you try to get domestic production, those take a few years to get online. And just the increased demand means that like even as America produces more, if it uses more, it's still going to be very reliant on China.
You know, this is a subject that we've talked about a bit over the years, this dependence that the United States has on China for rare earth minerals, and the fact that China seems to be very good at looking long-term and seeing long-term consequences of decisions like this in a way that America does not. Is short-term thinking, whatever is going to make for the best deal in the short term, that's what we're going to go for. And then you end up with these kinds of strategic vulnerabilities as a result of that. The Biden administration definitely has this this short-term view with a lot of the policies that it is undertaking. It might have a little bit of a nice bloom in the immediate term, but then you end up with serious, serious problems long-term. And they don't seem to have any kind of an idea of just how beholden to China the United States has become.
Yeah, it is really short-term thinking because, I mean, we have rare earth minerals here. We just don't mine them, one, because they're bad for the environment, and two is they're so much cheaper to buy from China. But probably the greatest proof of the strategic vulnerability of this is the fact that China subsidizes its rare earth mineral sector to the point where they're actually selling these things at a loss. Which means they're not, China doesn't mine and sell rare earth minerals for profit because they're not making a profit. They sell them for political leverage, which basically means they just passed a new law this year saying that they reserve the right, which, I mean, it's a dictatorship. They have whatever rights they want to cut off rare earth mineral exports if they want. And so, I mean, just right at this point, right now, just the threat to cut off rare earth minerals to the United States gives them tremendous leverage to, like, force the United States to do things. Because, like I said, even though America has the minerals here, most experts estimate that it would take 3 or 4 years to get the mines back up and operational to the point where America's self-sufficient. So in the short term, you need to play nice with your main supplier, which is tremendously prophetically significant. Actually, in the United States and Britain in prophecy, it doesn't mention rare earth minerals as much. They weren't as big a part of our society when that book was written. But it does highlight a prophecy in Deuteronomy 33, where God had promised to give the descendants of Manasseh and Ephraim the chief things of the ancient mountains and the precious things of the lasting hills. So, I mean, things that are in mountains and hills, these are things like your mining. And in United States and Britain in prophecy, I mean, it talks a lot about, well, this is a prophecy about how much gold and iron and steel and copper and aluminum and cobalt America will possess in the end time. And then it goes through the statistics about how they stopped mining those things and started relying on foreign nations. Rare earth minerals, they call them rare earth minerals because they're more rare than gold or aluminum or copper or cobalt. But we have a lot of those in the United States too, but we're not mining them. We're not extracting them. We're choosing to rely on the Communist Party of China for those instead. And so, I mean, the fact that we possess them is a fulfillment of that prophecy in Deuteronomy 33. But the fact that we don't use them is basically a fulfillment of that prophecy in Leviticus 26. About, like, I've broken the pride of your power. I mean, like, you have the power to be militarily self-sufficient. And that is really the biggest strategic vulnerability. One of the articles we can put in the show notes is from Rob Morley. It's entitled Minerals, Crumbling Bedrock of U.S. Security. And he actually goes through some history at the beginning part of that about how America's founding fathers implemented a national strategy of promoting industrial and military self-sufficiency once they realized how dependent we were on France and the Netherlands for everything from gunpowder to iron to blankets to clothing and whatever else we needed during the Revolutionary War. A couple centuries after that, America really prided on itself. It's like our military and our society can be self-sufficient. And it's really only been since, like I said, I think in terms of rare earth minerals, it's actually been since about 1987 that we shut down those mines and started relying on China and other nations for these vital pieces of technology that our military depends on. Basically giving other nations the ability to, like, blackmail us into, like, well, if you don't do this or do that, you won't get these things, and then you'll have a 4-year window while you're ramping up your mines where you're in a tight spot.
Well, we will link to that article in the show notes, Minerals, Crumbling Bedrock of U.S. Security. And keep your eye on this infrastructure bill. Andrew's continuing to dig into more details about it, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it in the days ahead. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, warnings of an Iranian warship delivering weapons to Venezuela, China continuing its aggressive activity in Asia, now illegally taking over territory in Bhutan, and reports that a researcher tied to the Wuhan lab actually thanked Dr. Anthony Fauci for dismissing the lab leak theory. All this and more after a short break. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We've spoken quite a lot about just how pro-Iran the administration of Joe Biden is. This has led to an increasingly belligerent Iran in recent months. The most recent example is happening in America's own hemisphere, an Iranian warship headed this way. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, Politico over the weekend released a story based on U.S. intelligence that there is a massive Iranian warship, the largest warship it has in its navy, headed down the African coast en route to Venezuela, most likely Venezuela. And it was confirmed by the Pentagon on Wednesday that this was, in fact, the case. The Pentagon said, quote, "The delivery of such weapons would be a provocative act and a threat to our partners in this hemisphere As such, we would reserve the right to take appropriate measures in concert with our partners to deter the delivery or transit of such weapons. So this is over 700 feet long vessel. There's seven attack boats, fast attack boats, that are on the vessel right now, according to satellite imagery, as well as a host of other weapons could be on it that we're just not sure about. And as yet, it is yet to arrive in Venezuela. However, it definitely seems like the Iranians won't be deterred to make this delivery shipment of weapons to what has become their most important ally in South America. This is a relationship that goes back many years. It's a relationship that was fostered during the Obama years and that the President Obama allowed to fester on purpose, deliberately stopping American intelligence agencies' research and prosecution of individuals that were supporting Iran, supporting Hezbollah from Venezuela. There was a massive ring of illegal finances that were being, or money laundering that was taking place based on Venezuelan drugs that were sold to America that would go through a series of different sales, which would end up in the end with $200 million being deposited into Hezbollah accounts inside Lebanon each month. And the Obama administration sought to slow that or even stop the prosecutors from going after those involved in that. And so what we're seeing right now under the Biden administration is a really interesting return to this close relationship with Iran and Venezuela that's being allowed to take place under the eye of the Americans.
This is really a concerning push by Iran into the Western Hemisphere. What is it after here?
I think it's got two goals here. You've got Venezuela is another nation that is under sanction by the United States. And so these two nations, Iran and Venezuela, can get around U.S. sanctions by basically trading with each other. And this is what we've seen. We've seen massive oil tankers and petroleum tankers make their way through 2019 and 2020 all the way to Venezuela. And we've seen plane loads of gold bricks making their way from Venezuela to Iran, as well as plane flights of specialized equipment to maintain the oil refineries inside Venezuela coming from Iran. So they have a mutually beneficial relationship that they can get around U.S. sanctions. But you also have Iran that's not helping out Venezuela for the fact that Iran just needs money. Iran is interested at making Venezuela not just into an ally of its purposes, but also to be a controlling factor inside Venezuela. There were reports last year that Iran was about to stage a coup to remove Maduro from being president in favor of the current number two inside Venezuela, who is a known Iranian aligned figure. He was designated, Donald Trump actually put a bounty on his head. Tariq Assimi is his name. He's the number two in Venezuela. He's got a $10 million bounty on his head right now, not because of what he does in Venezuela necessarily for the Venezuelan government, but because of his ties to the Iranians and the IRGC. And so through these actions of sending oil, sending petroleum, sending weapons to Venezuela, you do have the Iranians that want to create the forward operating base to act against the United States' interest. And this might not be lobbing missiles at first from Venezuela into the United States. This is probably getting Iranian foot soldiers over there that they can get Venezuelan passports and make it easier for them to transit into the United States on those passports. We know they've done that. CNN wrote a report on that back in 2017, I believe. And so this is happening. Iran is moving into having a close relationship with Venezuela, and it's a way that they can get closer to the United States. Now, some are coming out and saying, why is Iran doing this? They're negotiating a new nuclear weapons agreement, a new nuke deal with the Biden administration. Why are they provoking the Biden administration? But they're seeing it the wrong way. They're in nuclear talks with the Biden administration right now. And for that very purpose, they feel like they can get away with what they want, because the Biden administration is the one that wants the deal so bad, not the Iranians. This is just what they did during the negotiations the first time around, when Iran virtually took over Syria and Obama had a red line and said, don't you dare cross that red line, Assad regime, and use chemical weapons because we'll come after you. But he didn't, because he couldn't, because the Iranians wanted a nuclear deal. And so you do have a strongly worded statement from the United States now saying, do not give the weapons to Venezuela. Do not make your way down to Venezuela. However, the Iranians are leveraging the nuclear talks right now to push at even the United States of America and push into the Western Hemisphere, something that we have not seen the United States really allow anybody to do for decades.
Brent has written a major article on this subject that appears right now at watchjerusalem.co.il, the trumpet.com sister website, Iran establishing a base of operations in Venezuela. We'll link to it in the show notes. Brent, any final takeaways that you'd like to leave us with from that article?
Well, I think the most important element here, or one of them, is to recognize that this is an action, or what we're seeing Iran and with Venezuela come together. It is something that was, the seeds were planted really during the Obama years and the first nuclear deal. In response to that deal, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, wrote an article, The Worst Foreign Policy Blunder in American History. And he said this, quote, "These were not just foolish political calculations. These were dangerous and delusional, and they led America and the world down a path of destruction. The deadly ramifications of what the Obama administration did are beyond measuring and could take years to fully play out." And that's what we're seeing now. We are seeing these side deals that were worked out, or these relationships that were worked out during the nuclear deal negotiations, and we are seeing how dangerous they have become, to the point now of you have a massive military vessel containing what we don't know what, headed into America's backyard from the number one state sponsor of terrorism. This should be very concerning for Americans.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. China continues its brazen aggressive behavior, the latest example occurring in the nation of Bhutan. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, satellite imagery has emerged showing that over the last few years, China has built a new town high in the Himalayas called Gyalafug. And the remarkable and the very brazen thing about this new town is that even though the Chinese claim that it's in China, it's actually well inside the nation of Bhutan. So this story was just broken by Robert Barnett in Foreign Policy, and he points out that Gyalafug is one of three villages that China has illegally built in Bhutan's Baol region in the last few years. And then China has also constructed many miles of roads there and five small military outposts and many other smaller installations. So this all means that the entire region, which makes up about 1% of Bhutan's total territory, is now effectively under Chinese control. And, you know, China has, of course, installed lots of its people in these posts and villages as well. Official Chinese rhetoric calls these people soldiers without uniforms, and it orders them to, quote, make every village a fortress and every household a watch post. So China's really taking a stand here. And with Gyalafug, it's especially provocative because this is in an area that is viewed by Bhutan as one of its most sacred places. It's a place of just exceptional religious significance to Bhutan's Buddhists, which are, you know, pretty much most of the people in Bhutan. And that's actually why China selected this location to illegally build on. It wants to pressure Bhutan into giving China a different part of the country, a part on the western border that is adjacent to India. So the Chinese think that if they build and kind of desecrate this sacred place where Gyalafug is located, then that will pressure Bhutan into giving China control over that other area near India. And then China would have a major military advantage over India in the event of war. So, you know, in the first half, we talked about China's long-term thinking, and this is really an example of the Chinese thinking many moves ahead here. But this does, it does openly violate a treaty that China made with Bhutan back in 1998, not that long ago, and they specifically promised not to ever unilaterally change their border. And Robert Barnett points out that because of that treaty, this is a, quote, dramatic escalation in China's effort to expand its land in the Himalayas. And he said that the development is, quote, more provocative than anything China has done on its land borders in the past. So, you know, what's happened here is just a very, very brazen move, even for the Chinese Communist Party.
So we were talking before the show about just this kind of a PR campaign that China is putting out there to try to put a nice face on a lot of these activities. Tell us about that and just how it's belied by its actions here.
Yeah, this was the type of story that would almost make you laugh if it weren't so tragic. But it was on Wednesday that Chinese President Xi Jinping told senior Communist Party officials that China's having a PR problem because, of course, China is bent on expanding its power all over the world, but many nations are becoming fearful of it. So he told his cronies to create a, quote, lovable and respectable image of China, so that other nations won't fear it, and so that they'll let China come in and dominate them, basically. So, you know, I think that's just laughable when you consider all the press that China's had lately over Xinjiang, Hong Kong, the South China Sea, you know, Inner Mongolia, the COVID pandemic, the list goes on and on. And now we have this story of China seizing land in Bhutan in a way that openly violates a treaty made just a few years ago. So it's it almost seems childish that he thinks they can just wage a little campaign here and convince people to ignore all of their behavior that they have no intention of changing. But this is it's just a chilling reality, everything that we're seeing with China. But the Bible tells us that as alarming as these current trends are, they will continue. China will keep becoming more and more dominant regionally and globally, and the U.S. will be marginalized. There's a Bible passage that touches on this in the Gospel of Luke, where it talks about the times of the Gentiles. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote a detailed article about that in our February 2020 print edition. And one part of that says, when this prophecy is completely fulfilled, there will be two major powers, one revolving around Russia and China, and the other around Germany. End quote. So, you know, China's brazen seizing of Bhutan's territory, it may seem like something small, but it is a part of China's overall rise and this overall shift in global power toward China. So it is helping set the stage for that times of the Gentiles prophecy to be fulfilled.
Well, we have an article at thetrumpet.com that it should appear shortly, if it's not there already. Dramatic escalation. China seizes Bhutan's territory. This is by Mr. Jacques here, so go check that out. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And speaking of China's PR problem, information about China's culpability for the COVID-19 pandemic is coming out all the time, specifically undermining the credibility of America's most famous doctor, Anthony Fauci. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, in hindsight, Dr. Fauci probably should have hired Hillary Clinton as a technical advisor, because he's been far less successful than her at keeping his email correspondence under wraps. There's been a number of leaks over the past week of just all the emails going back and forth amongst the staff at his organization discussing whether or not the coronavirus leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, all during the time when Dr. Fauci and the mainstream media were publicly telling people that only a crazy conspiracy theorist would give credence to the fact that the coronavirus could have leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Yeah, one particular the email that caught my attention was actually from Peter Dzak, who is a zoologist at the nonprofit organization Eco Alliance. That's the group that actually funneled the money from the National Institute of Health to the Wuhan Institute. And he was the main point of contact between the United States and Communist China in the collaboration on research on bat coronaviruses. And so when people are talking about the money that we sent to China to develop this bioweapon, it was coming through this Eco Alliance group. And he sent a particular email that's now leaked to Anthony Fauci, where he said, I just wanted to say a personal thank you on behalf of our staff and collaborators for publicly standing up and stating that the scientific evidence supports a natural origin for COVID-19 from a bat to human spillover, not a lab release from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And so that's basically an email where Dr. Fauci is up there saying that there's no way this could have leaked. And then this man from the Eco Alliance had sent him emailed him a personal thank you for, it's like, thank you for telling everyone in the world that there's no way this could have leaked, when it was his institution that was working with the Wuhan scientists to develop bat coronaviruses. So if it does turn out that the coronavirus originated as a leak, and all the evidence is pointing in that direction currently, I mean, he should have known more than anyone who's not an actual communist Chinese scientist, what that money was being used for. Yeah, we'll put an article in the show notes from Mr. Stephen Fleury titled "The Fauci Virus" that really goes through the whole story of how Dr. Fauci was saying that this could never be a leak, and then the evidence that shows that it probably was, and just like the two talking and the lies that he's been telling, and what that tells us about just like the spiritual sickness in the state of the American politics. Just Isaiah 1 says that the whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. And I mean, this story really does illustrate that like nothing else.
Yeah.
And this trumpet brief was written before some of the more recent email leaks, but everything we've talked about on the program today concerning this just really adds more evidence to confirm the main point of that trumpet brief about just the culpability of the American deep state in what really was a Chinese either faux pas or deliberate effort to start this pandemic.
Mm. The Fauci virus is the name of the article. We'll link to in the show notes. And thank you very much for that, Andrew. One final story. The nation of Croatia just made its biggest arms purchase since becoming an independent nation. This says a lot about who it seeks alliance and cooperation with, a lot that is really prophetically significant. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
It does say a lot. This is a former communist country. You know, it used to be part of Yugoslavia. And then to see it's making its biggest arms purchase and making a clear direction towards NATO, I mean, that's not a surprise, but it's definitely you can see the effect that the Yugoslav war had, where this once kind of communist bloc was not fully aligned with the Soviet Union, but still a kind of a communist system. It now moving west, and not just west in general. They specifically chose France's program, France's Rafael planes to replace their Russian-made MiGs. They could have bought from Israel, Sweden, the United States. But you see them, throwing in their lot with this European military system.
Now, Croatia trying to tie itself to Europe, this brings up troubling historical associations. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has talked quite a lot about Europe's designs on Croatia and the Balkans area. Remind us of what he has said about that.
Yes, it is very prophetic to see Croatia making what one of their leaders called the basis of our security, and building that around France. You know, there's a whole lot of history here where Croatia was very famously aligned with the Nazis, with the Axis power during World War II. They had a very cruel regime there that also had close ties with the Catholic Church and with the Vatican. And so then when in the early 1990s, you had both Germany and the Vatican play an instrumental role in breaking Croatia away from Yugoslavia, that stirred a whole lot of troubling memories. It came right after Germany unified, and it was one of the biggest signs of both Germany and the Catholic Church, you know, having very clear designs in world news and then going forwards and acting on those. It showed that Germany was back in terms of being a major country, kind of throwing its weight around. And because of how much Bible prophecy talks about Germany and the blindness that we talked about that Britain and America have towards Germany that we talked about in the first half, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote a whole booklet just talking about how this conflict exposes Germany, how you can see a whole lot of fulfilled prophecy and prophecy in the process of being fulfilled in that conflict. And so, you know, that booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, is an excellent place to go to just to see Bible prophecy being fulfilled in practice, an event that's relatively recent history, but just shows the Bible's accuracy in prophesying world events.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We also have an article, Croatia Purchases French Fighter Jets, available at thetrumpet.com. We'll link to that, as well as Gerald Fleury's booklet, Germany Conquers the Balkans, in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that. Richard, I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Anne Radcliffe: a well-informed mind is the best security against the contagion of folly and of vice. The vacant mind is ever on the watch for relief and ready to plunge into error to escape from the languor of idleness. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.